The podcast edition of Midori House was first aired on the 2nd of December for Monocle 24 here in London. Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London with me, Steve Bloomfield. Ahead in the next hour, we'll be hearing the latest from Egypt with our Cairo correspondent, Jack Schenker. We'll also speak to Lord Foster about his plans for a new airport in London.
So London isn't the bottleneck, London isn't the congestion point. This feeds prosperity, communication, mobility across the nation, and it connects to a hub.
And we'll be rounding off our look at the new issue of Monocle when art director James Malheur and photo director Poppy Shibamoto pop into the studio. All that and some rather good music right here in the next 60 minutes on Midori House. But first, let's get the latest news from around the world with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said a new EU treaty is needed to help set up fiscal union and to impose stricter budget discipline. Speaking in the Bundestag, she promised concrete steps towards closer integration of individual Eurozone country policies, as well as an effective crisis management plan. However, British Prime Minister David Cameron said he was not convinced that the EU treaty needs changing to tackle the crisis. Speaking after talks in Paris with French President Nicolas Sarkozy, Mr. Cameron called for a successful outcome to a summit next week when Franco-German plans will be put to European Union leaders. China's climate envoy Su Wei has said his country could be willing to sign off on an agreement for binding cuts on the gases blamed for global warming. The move could open the door to rescue talks over the future of the Kyoto Protocol, as well as boosting UN climate change negotiations in Durban that have been deadlocked this week over binding targets. Earlier, the Japanese climate envoy warned that simply extending the Kyoto Protocol emission cuts would not be enough. One activist, Alan Murphy, explained the nature of the protests in Durban.
Today, people are coming just to make more aware that the masses of people, the 99% of the world's population, are aware of the problems, aware of who's causing the problems, and are proposing the solutions.
The United Nations top human rights forum has strongly condemned Syria for gross and systematic violations by its forces, including executions, which it said may amount to crimes against humanity. The 47-member forum adopted a resolution put forward by the European Union calling for the main bodies of the UN to consider a report which found that crimes of humanity had been committed and to take appropriate action. Both China and Russia voted against the resolution. Former US President George W. Bush has urged wealthy nations to help poor countries with resources to fight cancer and AIDS. Speaking during a two-day visit to Zambia, Mr. Bush visited the Bush Clinical Study Site in the capital Lusaka, where he launched an initiative to reduce the number of women dying from cervical cancer. He outlined the need for the West not to lose sight of global health problems.
What is needed is support. Support from the developed world. Support from people who have been blessed to live in a nation or nations where we're comfortable. And one of my concerns is that the United States decides that our problems are so severe at home that we ignore the voices of others.
Mr. Bush's Zambian visit comes as Amnesty International called for his arrest over human rights violations. The Afghan President Hamid Karzai has arrived in Germany ahead of next week's Bonn conference on Afghanistan. The Afghan leader was greeted by German Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle, where he praised Germany's help in bringing about stability in his country. And a French restaurant where diners cannot see what they are eating, often spill their wine and must conduct conversations while staring into pitch darkness has proved such a success in Europe that it's making a foray into the Americas. After expanding from Paris into London, Moscow, Barcelona and St. Petersburg, the Don Le Noir chain, staffed by visually impaired waiters, will open an outlet in the neon-lit tourist hub of New York's Times Square this month. Those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. Now look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather. in association with Kuoni Travel.
Hello there. In Europe, the business week ends with spells of rain and wind across the northern half of the continent. France and Germany, wet and windy weather during Saturday. The best weather remains across the Eastern Med and the Balkans. Sunshine here. Here's Saturday's city forecast. London, 7 degrees with a mix of sun and rain. In Frankfurt, 11 Celsius, rain and strong winds here. Copenhagen, 7 Celsius, rain and very strong winds gusting to 70 kilometres an hour. In Budapest, 10 Celsius and partly cloudy. Air travel is looking bumpy. Takeoffs and landings at many Western European and Scandinavian airports. Low-level turbulence due to high winds. Also, the jet stream is raging over the Atlantic at the moment. North America, Thursday, the Santa Ana winds were causing havoc in parts of California. Quite a weather event there. Toppled trees just outside Los Angeles. Much quieter now. The other side of the US, sunshine on the Atlantic seaboard, staying like it all weekend. More snow in the Rockies and the Northern Plains. Okay, Saturday's city forecast. New York City, 8 Celsius and sunny. In Miami, 25 and sunny. Chicago, 8 Celsius and light rain. In San Francisco, 17 Celsius and sunny. Asia Pacific, drenching rains sweeping Japan Friday through Saturday. The good news is that the rainstorms shouldn't last for very long. In fact, in Tokyo, the end of the weekend is looking sunny. Here's the Asia Pacific Saturday outlook. Tokyo, 14 with rain. Shanghai, 9 and sunny. Hong Kong, 19 and sunny. Singapore, 32 and a chance of thunderstorms. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Thomas. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The time is approaching 18:07. Stay with us.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Ein Monocle 24 Tag, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ihr Jokosau.
Tämä on Monocle 24. Monocle
24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. Now, as expected, the biggest winners in this week's parliamentary elections in Egypt were Islamists. The Muslim Brotherhood's Freedom and Justice Party topped the polls, while the ultra-conservative Salafists, Al-Nur, came second. Both parties have moved swiftly to assuage fears among liberals that they will seek to radically change Egyptian society. A spokesman for Al-Nur said earlier today he was far more concerned about the 40 million Egyptians who don't have clean water than the 20,000 who drink alcohol. To discuss what these results might mean for Egypt, I'm joined on the line from Cairo by our correspondent Jack Schenker. Jack, thanks for joining us today. What do you make of the results that have come in so far?
Well, it's certainly an interesting mix, and it's got a lot of Egyptian liberals worried. I was in a bar a couple of nights ago, and various people were clinking glasses and saying, well, let's enjoy this. It's probably the last time we're going to be able to drink beer and sit with unveiled women. The fact is that these kind of fears are largely exaggerated. The Brotherhood, who look like they're going to emerge as the largest party, and even the more conservative Salafists, are making a lot of effort to try and reach out, particularly in the case of the Brotherhood, to reassure its critics in the West and also at home, and saying, look, we're not trying to impose some kind of Iranian Islamic theocracy on Egypt. We want to form coalitions with liberals, with leftists, with forces across the political spectrum, and try and ensure that we work together to rebuild Egypt and to move forward into a democratic, relatively liberal civil society in the future. But certainly this has been a triumph for the Islamist part of the political spectrum. They've been organizing across the country in very poor areas, not just election campaigning, but providing services and welfare where the state's been absent for decades now. And the result is that people are looking for them at this time of crisis. They're looking at them to step in. And as many analysts have said, if you'd held democratic elections really any time during the Mubarak reign, and even before that, since the Egyptian Revolution of 1952, this is the result you would have got. You know, Egypt is largely a conservative Muslim society, and that's been reflected in these results.
Let me just pick you up on that point, Jack. I mean, the liberals, you know, can, you know, in a sense, moan all they want about these results, but this is their own fault, really, isn't it? They've spent months trying to get their act together, and they've failed.
Well, that's true to a certain extent. I mean, a couple of caveats. First of all, bear in mind that under 30 years of Mubarak rule, most sort of legal avenues of political opposition were completely outlawed. Any kind of mainstream dissent was shut down quite brutally, usually. One of the only ways in which political opposition could be channeled was through various religious networks, through organizations like the Muslim Brotherhood. So whereas the Brotherhood has existed actually for 80 years, the new liberal parties that, and leftist parties that have arisen since the 25th of January revolution have only had a few months to get their act together. So it's taken them a lot longer to build up the funding, build up the networks. Egypt is a huge country, both geographically and in terms of population, 80 million people. And to establish yourself as a political force in a country where, you know, there isn't a tradition of democratic election, that obviously takes time.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing the Liberals would say very quickly is that especially in the last few weeks, they have been holding rallies in Tahrir, trying to bring down the military council and bring an end to army rule. And they've been being shot and killed as a result, and they've been throwing their efforts into that. So they certainly wouldn't take kindly to being told that, you know, they just haven't got their act together. They would argue they've been fighting more important battles. But certainly it's a wake-up call for them that they are going to have to increase their organization to take on the Islamists electorally.
And now you say they need to sort of maybe step up their game electorally. The presidential elections look like they're going to be moved forward. There was some talk they might be as late as 2013. Now, after everything that happened in Tahrir Square over the last couple of weeks, the military council said they might be as early as July of next year. Firstly, do you think that timetable is going to be stuck to? But perhaps more importantly, who are the real contenders now, and do the election results we've just seen change that?
Well, in terms of when the elections are going to happen, as you say, the military council has, under pressure from sustained kind of anti-junta protests in the past 2 weeks, promised that a poll will be held in June 2012. I think it will be very politically difficult for them not to stick to that. There's been a lot of debate over whether the tens of thousands who have been rallying in Tahrir against military rule represent the rest of the country. It's a debate which is longer than we can fit into this segment, but the short answer is that whether or not that they represent the whole of the country, it's clear that people do want a swift and orderly end to military rule. I think there's no doubt about that. People don't want to see this country turning into a permanent military dictatorship. So politically, the military will I think, have to hold elections in June 2012 for the presidency. Whether or not they try and shoehorn their own candidate, either an army general or indeed a kind of a fig leaf candidate who a patsy who will do their bidding, that remains to be seen. In terms of the main contenders, at the moment, the guy who's ahead in the polls is Amr Moussa. That is the former head of the Arab League. He was a minister under the Mubarak regime, and he's widely interpreted to be the sort of closest to the military and the closest to the old regime. And many young revolutionaries would be very disheartened if he won, because it wouldn't represent, in their eyes, much of a step forward. There are a couple of liberal alternatives, people like Hamdine Sabahi, people like Mohamed El Baradei, who listeners will probably know is the former UN nuclear weapons chief, and we've profiled him in Monocle before. He's a very influential technocrat and diplomat internationally, but has some problems with garnering support at home, largely because he's seen as someone who spent most of his career abroad. And then there are a series of Islamist candidates, ranging from moderate Islamists such as Abul Monim Fatouh, who was once a member of the Muslim Brotherhood but has actually broken away from them after they said they wouldn't run a candidate for presidency. He broke away, and various other Islamist candidates as well, some of whom are more conservative. In terms of, you know, who will win given these election results, well, these election results in Parliament really aren't that much of a surprise. I don't think they changed the game too much. The Brotherhood, which will emerge as the strongest party in Parliament, has said very clearly that it will not run a candidate for president. It can't really go back on that promise now, although that doesn't mean that the Brotherhood won't support, so, you know, won't throw its support behind someone. It'll be interesting to see who that is.
Okay, Joe, very briefly, just before you go, what's happening in Tahrir Square now? I mean, have there still been protests, obviously, sort of while the elections are going on, but subsequently, are there still people there on a regular basis? Are they still planning to be there for a while?
There are, the occupation is ongoing and protesters are planning to stay there. Many people told me personally that they're not going to leave until the Mushir leaves. That's the Arabic word for field marshal. And they're referring to Mohammed Tantawi, who is the head of the military council and really the target of protesters' anger in the same way that Hosni Mubarak was earlier this year. So many people are planning to stay and it's closed to traffic. It's controlled by civilian checkpoints.
Yeah.
But the numbers are much smaller than they were on previous Fridays. There was a big demonstration today to commemorate the martyrs, the people who died in the violence of the past couple of weeks. But certainly numbers are smaller, but those that are there say that they won't move until the military government falls.
Okay, Jack Schenker in Cairo, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. It's been a mixed week for the world of civil aviation, with American Airlines parent, AMR, filing for Chapter 11 and British architect Norman Foster unveiling a compelling vision for putting the United Kingdom back in the aviation and transport game. On Monday, he unveiled his vision for Thames Hub at Oxford University, complete with a four-runway airport, high-speed orbital rail link around London, shipping port and much more. The total price tag? A mere £50 billion. Our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, spoke to Lord Foster on the line from Lausanne.
Maybe there's finally an awareness that the investment in infrastructure, which is really about optimism, it's about confidence. And if you look back, our Victorian forebears, I mean, they had these incredible initiatives that anticipated needs beyond their own time. I think there's an awareness that we're trading on that creaking infrastructure, that we haven't renewed it, we haven't invested in a future for generations to come. And linked into all this are new issues of energy, obsolescing nuclear power plants, the need for a new Thames barrier. We have economic problems of high unemployment, slow growth, disparity between the north and the south in terms of wealth, housing shortage in the southeast. If you bundle all these together and look in a holistic, integrated way, and you create a spine that would embrace high-speed rail, commuter tracks, freight tracks, and that goes north-south, and it has this great sphere of influence either side of it, can protect the countryside, could be in a landscaping tradition in sensitive areas, or settlements would be tunneled below the ground elsewhere, could be cut into the landscape, the soil which is excavated makes banks either side, the banks bury the power cables, broadband transmission, which is needed, again, an information highway. It could link into waste-to-energy plants to provide green energy. And then this orbits to the north of London. So London isn't the bottleneck. London isn't the congestion point. This feeds prosperity, communication, mobility across the nation. And it connects to a hub. That hub contains the airport, it contains a tidal power station, river crossing, tidal barrier, and a rail interchange. The tidal power station can power a quarter of a million homes, or it could power the whole airport. You take away all the risk, very considerable risk, of overflying London. Heathrow could be an incredible site for a model community. It has the most conservative estimate related to its $12 billion debt. That would cover more than half the cost of the $20 billion airport, which is part of a much wider initiative.
There's, of course, a bigger branding issue here. And oftentimes, you know, I speak to people in the city, and of course, you speak to people in government. And when you challenge them on this and you say, listen, there are people in Malaysia, in South Korea, in Brazil, who've moved on from London, and oftentimes they'll respond saying, oh, don't be ridiculous, because London is still the center of the world and we've got this incredible brand and people want to come here and our infrastructure, you know, is fine. It will see us through. Do you believe in this sort of just see us through, let's put a Band-Aid on it mentality?
No, the Band-Aid mentality, I mean, its times are over. I mean, even if you had a third runway, it doesn't change the picture. No, it's no longer a hub. We do business in those emerging economies. They're not served by Heathrow. You have to go somewhere else to go there. And it's not only moving out of the UK, it's those people who want to visit. You're aware, if one looks at Beijing, if one looks at Hong Kong, in Hong Kong, they leveled a mountain. They created an area out of sea the size of Heathrow. They moved the airport overnight and created a fantastic development site. Beijing was completed in 4 years. It's the size of the whole of Heathrow put together, plus an extra sixth terminal. I mean, Stansted went on forever. And the time spent in a public inquiry or construction time, those don't change the realities. The reality is that we have the examples of Victorian predecessors. We have inspirational examples from emerging economies. And for an idea which is, which if you like, is a vote of confidence in the future of the UK, as in the past, there would be no shortage of investors. And the sums are not large. I mean, with the offset of Heathrow for the airport element of it, you're talking, what, about £8 billion?
Which is not a vast sum. I want to go back to just the symbolism, because I think, you know, certainly right thinking and clever people would absolutely agree. You know, there is definitely a time, there is a need, you know, for something to happen, and I think many have come to the conclusion either we're going to be in the game in this country or we're not. And it seems that we're certainly hurtling in the direction of nots. And do you feel that, you know, symbolically as well, that the UK right now just, you know, it's not just a hub. I mean, it really needs a great grand project, which, as you said, in a way, you know, it's a project of foresight like what the Victorians did before.
Yes, I mean, the other thing is that you can break this initiative, which in its totality, with the orbital, with the barrier, with the extra infrastructure, in its totality, it's a $50 billion, although, as I said, the airport itself is only 20 of that, not counting a Heathrow offset. So it can be done in phases. It can emerge over time. It's not a one-shot concept. And really, I think your point about the debate is a very apt one. And if this adds constructively to the debate, then that is positive. What I would say is that if as a nation there is a decision not to do anything and to slide further down the scale with all the implications that follow from that, particularly in terms of future generations, then I think there should be at least the courage to confront that and state it as a policy, and not just something that, in a way, we, you know, heads are buried in the sand, as it were.
Lord Foster, with all the goodwill in the world, knowing this isn't China, where, of course, they're able to compress these types of timelines, but, you know, but if we got planning for it and if the financing, you know, was in place, how long do you think it would take?
You're talking 10, 15 years in terms of the totality. You could make that faster, and undoubtedly, if it was in Asia, it would be faster. But taking into account the democratic processes, the exchanges, there's no reason, given a political will, if you like, and I think there are very strong signs of that. I mean, I think that it's wonderful that the Treasury is being given the brief to look at infrastructure. So if there was a will, 10 years, maximum 15.
And we're joined now by Tyler. Well, he sounds quite optimistic at the end there. 10 years, maybe 15.
But... Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think the bigger issue is whether there's the political will. And last week we had some people from Number 10 visiting us here as well. And there seems to be this momentum because I think this government, you know, fine from, you know, an electioneering point of view, it was great to say that we're not going to build any more runways, and that appeals to lots of people. But it ain't great for business when we've been through this era of austerity and people are thinking, well, how are we going to grow this country? And also, what will our role be, not within just within the immediate neighborhood, but what is our role globally? And I think that is the key issue.
And I guess also, if you're a government that's almost defined by cuts and what you're not doing, it's perhaps not a bad idea to have a big project, something which you can say, look, this is what we're all about. This is our big vision for the future.
Yeah, I mean, not to borrow a term from across the channel, but, you know, it is a question of what is the grand projet that this country has. And fine, we've seen, you know, some things come to light over the last weekend with Mr. Osborne's announcements. But again, nothing's particularly grand out of any of that. I mean, these are almost just necessary things that need to be done.
It's a lot of thing about, you know, filling in potholes. And,
yeah, exactly. Yes. And so you would think that that's kind of business as usual. And I think what's very clever about the Foster plan is that he hasn't just said we're building four runways. He's talking about, you know, a container port. He is talking about, you know, also a huge, you know, rail element to it. You know, also coming up with a solution: what happens to life after Heathrow? And it's also not about just getting, you know, having one airport, because it's probably not going to be an airport for discount operators. You know, there'll be a life for Stansted. There'll probably be a life for Gatwick and even City Airport as well. So it is the idea of, you know, what, you know, and it could be clever for this government as well, that if they really get behind this, that they can, you know, they can say, you know, this was something that was, you know, that defined the Cameron era.
Are there, though, some things that we in the West struggle with? You know, he talked about, you know, Hong Kong levelling a mountain to build their airport, or in China they did it in 4 years, but then, you know, they shipped in 100,000 people from villages and made them work, you know,
we might have to do the same here as well.
When you say here, you mean Midori House? Or?
Yeah, well, here as well. No, exactly. We would have to probably do the same in the UK. But no, I think that, of course, so much of this already, and you know, it is... You know, it's quite remarkable when, as you said, there's an issue of how would we look at, you know, tens of thousands of workers brought in, and so much of the discussion already with this project has been a bird sanctuary. Now, I don't care what government that you look at in Asia, I don't think anyone would be too concerned about a bird sanctuary if it actually meant that it could also, you know, the trade off would be tens of millions more passengers a year.
Okay, Tyler Bridley, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Midori House on Monocle 24. We're back after this. It's approaching the bottom of the hour here on Midori House on Monocle 24. Later on the show, we'll be flicking through the latest pages of issue 49 of the magazine with photo director Poppy Shibamoto and art director James Malore. But first, here's the news headlines with James Luckhurst.
The German Chancellor Angela Merkel has said a new EU treaty is needed to help set up fiscal union and to impose stricter budget discipline. Speaking in the Bundestag, she promised concrete steps towards closer integration of individual Eurozone country policies, as well as an effective crisis management plan. China's climate envoy Su Wei has said his country could be willing to sign off on an agreement for binding cuts on the gases blamed for global warming. The move could open the door to rescue talks over the future of the Kyoto Protocol, as well as boosting UN climate change negotiations in Durban that have been deadlocked this week over binding targets. The United Nations' top human rights forum has strongly condemned Syria for gross and systematic violations by its forces, including executions, which it said may amount to crimes against humanity. The 47-member forum adopted a resolution put forward by the European Union calling for the main bodies of the UN to consider a report which found that crimes of humanity had been committed and to take appropriate action. Burma's government has reached a ceasefire agreement with one of the country's biggest ethnic rebel groups. The deal was agreed between the government and the Shan State Army and will soon be finalised. Former US President George W. Bush has urged wealthy nations to help poor countries with resources to fight cancer and AIDS. Speaking during a two-day visit to Zambia, Mr. Bush visited the Bush Clinical Study site in the capital Lusaka, where he launched an initiative to reduce the number of women dying from cervical cancer. The Afghan President Hamid Karzai has arrived in Germany ahead of next week's Bonn conference on Afghanistan. The Afghan leader was greeted by German Foreign Minister Guido Westerwelle, where he praised Germany's help in bringing about stability in his country. Those are the headlines here on Monocle 24.
You're with Midori House on Monocle 24. Now it's time for a song. This is Aluna George, You Know You Like It. That was Aluna George, You Know You Like It. And there was a reason why I played that, but we'll come on to that in a moment. Now, all week, we've been taking a look inside the new December-January issue of Monocle. So far, we've focused mainly on the words. Today, it's all about the pictures and the artwork. I've been joined in the studio by Monocle's art director, James Malore. Hello.
Hello.
Hello. And photo director, Poppy Shibamoto.
Hello, everyone.
James, Poppy, welcome. And James, you chose that song, didn't you?
I did, yeah. It's one of my friend's songs.
And, a special friend.
A special friend, yeah.
Special friend. Excellent. Good. Well, I'm glad we got a chance to play it. So what I was hoping you might be able to do is just give us a little bit of an idea of what your favourite things were. They've sort of both come in to the studio with sort of, well, obviously with the issue, but with little sort of post-it notes all over it. Poppy, you seem to have like picked out about a dozen different things there that you think are worth mentioning.
It's really a bit difficult because it's a really big issue.
Yeah, it is.
How many pages? 314.
It's our biggest,
plus
yeah.
Plus the supplement. So it's really hard to pick what my favourites are. I'm happy with all of them, so.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, no, what are your favourites? If you had to pick, and you seem to be lingering on my section, which is good.
Well, I'm going to come to that last.
Okay, go on then. What are the things that stand out for you?
Well, like, it's finally nice to see radio station shot. You know, like everyone's been talking about it, and now you can see it. And doesn't that look nice?
It does. It's over 8 pages on very nice paper stock as well.
Yeah, you look nice, Steve.
Thank you.
In a picture, I mean.
Yeah, there's a picture of me looking actually slightly gormless next to Hugo. Yeah, I'm not entirely sure what we're looking at, but...
We shot this on the day before launch or something like that, no?
Yeah, we did.
So
that was quite nice. Good.
And then the Monocle 100, the new type of supplement we produce, that looks really stunning. And we shot in a town called Latma in Austria.
Yeah.
And it's like sort of the end of road town. And photographer sort of got on a car, top of a car, and set up a tripod and then shot this shot.
This is number 2 in the Monocle 100,
yes.
the model village.
Yes. I don't want to give away number 1, so I'll go for number 2.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You don't want to give away number 1? Okay, we won't go on to that. But number 2, yeah, is
stunning,
quite
no?
a stunning picture.
So he's been waiting. He spent all day there in the town and then got up on a hill or mountain and ended up just sort of found a spot.
Just for the right light.
Yes.
It was well worth the wait. James,
yeah.
Any sort of standouts for you want to draw
for me,
attention
it's also,
to?
It's also in the Monocle 100, number 75 to 80, a well-stocked library. And we actually got the reading, the perfect reading room illustrated by our Canadian illustrators, Studio Teepee. And they've actually done quite a lot of work for us recently. They've been illustrating the window vinyls for all the shops. And they've also illustrated our Christmas cards. And they've just created a really cosy environment and it's just great to see printed. It's a real rich brown and...
Yeah, it looks lovely. And it's got... where are we? What books have we got here on the... How to Wrap Five Eggs.
That's a useful one.
That's a very useful one. John Berger, Ways of Seeing. I think there's an Ian Sinclair here somewhere, if I look closely enough. Oh, and there's a Winnie the Pooh collection as well, including The House at Pooh Corner.
Yeah,
which needs to be on everyone's, you know, in any well-stocked library is going to have that. Anything else out, not in the Monocle 100 that's... oh, look, it's a lovely picture of a dog. Number 100 in the Monocle 100.
You shouldn't have told everyone that.
Oh, really? Was that supposed to be a surprise?
Yeah.
Oh, no, but that should draw people in. I won't say what type of dog it is then, but it's a very, very cute dog. Actually, looks like it's stuffed, but it's not. It's real. It's very much alive. anyway, sorry, outside of the 100, James, what are the particular sort of, you know, well, particular favourites?
I actually really like the culture lead story about Turkey's soap opera empire and how it's exported across the world. It is so popular, and we've shot it in quite a different way to the way we usually do. It's very live, and we've caught all the characters, we've caught the production team, and the colours are great. It's quite dramatic, and it really stands out as a lead.
There's also, which is unusual for us, two people smoking in this as well. I've just noticed. I think they're actually sort of smoking on there, as in the shot, for dramatic purposes.
Of course.
Are there any new illustrators or particularly sort of smart illustrations that
people should be looking for?
We'll get on. No, we'll come to Denmark. I'm saving that.
Well, we actually we've been using different illustrators for the briefing pages. And we constantly, every issue, we try to rejuvenate our illustrators list. And for this issue, we went for the British illustrator Nishant Chokshi.
Very British name, that.
Yeah. And he did a great job on the briefing pages. I think they've really come to life. And I'm really happy with the results.
Yeah, I mean, even something as actually quite tricky to illustrate as rising tensions between Iran and Saudi Arabia, he's done incredibly well. And it just says it in a really quite artistic way, without having any sort of stereotypes or anything at all.
Yeah, he's got quite a fluid style. And for us, we get him to use just more of a vector-based, simple shape style, whereas normally he also illustrates for Bloomberg Businessweek, and he goes for more of a retro style.
Yeah.
And they're both great, but for us, we just really want the briefing pages to really kick, to really punch out.
To be vector-based.
To be vector-based, yep.
Excellent. I didn't know that's what we're aiming for, but it kind of makes sense. Poppy, you wanted to talk about a Denmark survey.
I really like the cover.
The cover is lovely.
Again.
Yeah, how would you describe that?
Try it. Do I do it?
Yeah, okay. No, go on. You try and describe that.
Wow. Beautiful blonde woman, a Danish woman, looking into the sea from the ferry, maybe?
Yeah, yeah.
Nice figure.
She has got a nice figure. And lots of red and white, obviously, as it is Denmark.
This actually took quite some time to... Because with the national surveys, we always try to make sure that the illustrators are from that country. So we really exhausted all of our contacts to try and find the best illustrator. And Mats Berg, who illustrated this cover, was the cream of the crop.
And so did you go through lots of different options and lots of people sending you things saying, what about this, what about that?
Yeah, yeah. We went through various different styles, but we knew ultimately that we wanted to move on the illustration style for the covers.
Yeah, it's very different from, for example, the Finland survey from last year. Very different. And also went down very well with the Danes themselves when we were in Washington earlier this week for the launch.
Oh, that's great.
For the launch party. Everyone connected with the embassy and the government there commented on how much they love the cover. So it was well worth going through all of those.
Fantastic.
Poppy, other highlights?
Okay, let's go to our third section.
Yes, excellent. Good.
Huntsville.
Head to the front. Huntsville is incredible, isn't it? Go on, explain what it looks like.
Well, page 81, it starts with amazing graphic shot of a rocket. And this photographer, I think, is quite still young, and then he's based there as well. So he's been quite excited about the project.
Oh, he's actually from Huntsville himself, is he?
No, he's from Alabama.
From Alabama.
I don't think he's from Huntsville. He's from Birmingham of the USA.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know how to pronounce that word. But
Birmingham.
Oh, but I tried. And it's all shot on film, and I think it looks really good.
Yeah, and you
I
can
mean,
tell
the
it's shot on film as well.
84 is really nice.
84, that's the, oh yeah, that's the rocket from sort of the side, isn't it? With sort of the back end of the rocket, so to speak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is. I'm
yeah,
sure
there's
a technical term, I'm sure, for the back end of a rocket, but still.
The
you
thrusters.
Know.
The
exactly.
Thrusters, yeah.
And then on the page 82, if you see it closely on the picture number 3, it's a shot of the exterior of Davidson Center for Space Exploration. You can really see the rocket inside through the window.
Can you?
Yeah,
it does the whole length of the building.
Oh yeah.
So
I hadn't, you know what, I hadn't even spotted that.
I knew that.
What, you knew that I hadn't spotted it?
Uh-huh.
No, normally my attention to detail is very good, but I'd obviously missed that.
That's why I pictured it.
Yes. It is indeed. Yeah, no, this was an absolute joy to look at. And it was it's one of those stories that you're never quite sure beforehand. I mean, with lots of stories, you don't know exactly
yes.
how it's going to look.
Yeah, of course.
You've got your hopes. But with Huntsville, it was quite blind. We knew that it was a good story, you know, words-wise. Mm. And we thought, well, you can't go too wrong with rockets. And sure enough, you can't. And yeah, it has got some. Let's quickly, just before we go, I just want to talk about, I mean, some of the best portraits I think we've had in the magazine for a very long time. I mean, our portraits are always pretty strong, but these are fantastic. This is a interview series with various presidents and political leaders from all over the world. Which ones? I'm resting on, you know, Crown Prince of Jordan as is the highlight.
Oh, it's fantastic!
It printed really well as well. It's a quite dark image, but it looks really stunning.
And it's sort of side on. It looks like Hitchcock. Or someone else described it, it looks like, smell the fart.
No, don't say that.
That's awful.
I think it's more Hitchcock.
Yeah, it's quite sculptural. It's absolutely beautiful. It's really printed well. And he's got a brilliant expression on his face. Very deep expression.
He has. And I really like the Colombian president as well.
Yes.
He looks happy.
Quite a charmer.
Yeah. Exactly. And it's nice, you get a sense of the presidential palace as well.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah, the corridor he's in with the little pillars and so on. Excellent. Okay. Well, James, Poppy, thank you very much for coming in. James, this is your debut, your radio debut.
Yeah.
Poppy's a veteran now.
She's
on all the time.
I didn't know I was allowed to do live.
But. Yeah, I know. Well, technically you're not, but luckily Tyler didn't hear, so it's fine. James, Poppy, thank you very much for coming in. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're back after this.
Every Monday, Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound, casts a keen eye across the week's cultural events, taking in cinema, art, music, media, literature, and some of the world's more exclusive events. That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday on Monocle 24 at 1900 London time and available on our Timeshift player and on iTunes.
This Christmas, why not give the gift of Monocle? A Monocle subscription spreads happiness and cheer throughout the year. Our special gift subscription is for only the most deserving recipients. The first issue comes hand-wrapped in Monocle design paper with an accompanying welcome letter which announces your gift and a personal message should you so wish. Subscribe now and we'll also send the new exclusive tote bag for 2011 for the first few issues. Our 12-month gift subscription costs £80 sterling, including magazine delivery costs to anywhere in the world. The recipient of your gift will receive 10 issues of the magazine and also 12 months access to all of our online content at monocle.com. So whether they've been naughty or nice, why not give them the gift of Monocle?
Welcome back to Midori House here on M24, and it's time for Meet the Neighbours. Only a stone's throw from Midori House's front door on Dorset Street is the Widescreen Centre, a small, family-owned retailer specialising in quality optical products. Like so many of our newly discovered neighbours in Marylebone, the Widescreen Centre is passionate about what it does. It turns out it's the top seller of astronomical products in London. We popped in a little earlier and spoke with co-owner Simon Bennett about his shop, his customers, and the lure of the nighttime sky.
The business has actually been in existence for 40 years, started in 71, and has stayed in the area for the first couple of years, was on Marylebone High Street, but then relocated to Dorset Street and has been here ever since. We've got multiple niche markets. We're London's only astronomy retailer. That's one of the things we do. We also are one of the few places still selling slide projectors. We sell projection screens. We do 3D equipment, things like microscopes, binoculars, night vision. We sell mainly to the amateur market, and it is a huge hobby, but a very, very diverse range of customers. We get a lot of young families coming in, which is great to see. We get a lot of people coming back to the hobby at a later stage in life when maybe they have a little bit more time and a little bit more money than they had in earlier years. And we see customers across the board. Our oldest customer just turned 100 years old. There is no typical amateur astronomer. There's a whole mix of people, men and women from all walks of life. We also do sell to schools, colleges, universities and observatories. Earlier this year we did an installation for Armagh Observatory in Northern Ireland. My favourite one to date was a telescope for Richard Branson on his island in the Caribbean. We did that 5 years ago. He flew me out there to install it.
What was that like?
Oh, that was such hard work. I'd never go there again. No, actually, it was. They're wonderful people. He's got a lovely family. It's a beautiful location. Unfortunately, it burned down a couple of months ago, so he lost what he had out there. But if he wants another one, the business is still here and will hopefully be here for another 40 years.
Are the skies clearer in the Caribbean or in Regent's Park?
Well, he's on an island in the Windward Islands, which is so named for a very good reason. And you do get a lot of sea spray and a bit of haze, but when it's clear, it is unlike anything you've ever seen. So it's a magical place, and I can certainly understand why he chose to buy an island out there.
I mean, you're clearly passionate about astronomy. How did you get into the field?
Well, at the age of eight, I had my first trip to the United States and to see my sister, who'd recently married. Apollo 15 was on the moon. It was a good summer for astronomy. Mars was at its best in the night sky. And it all kicked off from there, and that was 40 years ago, same year as the company started, and never looked back.
So you started as an amateur astronomer?
Yeah, I was a customer here until 8 years ago, and I came in one day to see my predecessor, who was a friend of mine, and he just quit. He just left to go for another job, and they had a vacancy here, and I thought about it for a while and ended up working here. And again, never look back. It surprised me. I'd never considered before working in my hobby. So the best thing you can do is work in your hobby because it's fun.
It's an expensive hobby too, isn't it?
Not necessarily. You can get a good telescope for £100, £200. There is something for everybody, but certainly the sky is the limit, no pun intended, and people can and do spend vast sums on their hobby. But you don't need a lot of money to enjoy the night sky. It's free. There's no license fee. It's not pay-per-view or anything like that. Anybody can go outdoors and enjoy the night sky. And you don't need large, sophisticated, high-tech equipment to enjoy it. To that end, a year ago, we formed an astronomical society in central London, something I'd wanted to do for years but never had the location to do it. Then a year ago it all started to fall into place, and we formed a society called the Baker Street Irregular Astronomers, with a slight Sherlock Holmes reference there. What happened was a returning customer turned out to be a police officer, and I got talking to him, and he's on Royal Park's duty and is based at Regent's Park. And he very quickly said he had a location in mind for such a meeting. So we went and looked at it, and a year and a half later, we've got about 700 members. We've got regular turnouts in Regent's Park once a month of up to 100 people. And again, it's free. Night sky is free. Just because you get a bunch of people together doesn't mean the price should go up. And we pitch it at an entry level, people can come along, look through other people's telescopes, chat informally, not only to us, but to other customer of ours and other amateur astronomers, and get good, free, impartial advice and enjoy the hobby. If it's clear, it's a bonus. That's the hobby in the UK. The weather doesn't always cooperate. But it's fun. Astronomy should be fun. We're unlike other societies because we're not intimidating, we're welcoming, and we just want to get as many new people into the hobby as we can.
It's a very communal activity.
It is, and everybody's invited.
It seems that this country, though, would be a particularly poor place to view the sky, though. Is that not the case?
Well, it's a different hobby to what it is for example, our American cousins, who can pretty much choose which night of the year from the calendar they want to go out and observe. They can look and say, okay, next Thursday I'm going to get my telescope out and observe the sky. We can't do that here because you need to fit in with the weather. But when it is clear here, you do get some very, very clear skies. And even from central London, you can do a huge amount of astronomy and enjoy it. But you just have to be a little bit patient. You have to wait for the gaps in the clouds. You have to wait for those clear nights. But when you do, it's worth the wait because it's such a great hobby.
What's your favorite thing to look at in the sky?
It changes. There's so much of it. At the moment, Jupiter is the one to look at because it's so bright. It's a huge planet. There's so much to look at, and it's always different. I like looking at the moon because no matter where you are, even in the centre of town, when the skies are bright orange, you can always look at the moon, and it's always different. There's always something new to look for. It's a phenomenal hobby, and it's not just a nighttime hobby. The sun during the daytime is amazing to look at with the right equipment, and there's always something new in the sky.
That was Daniel Giacopelli at the Widescreen Centre. You're listening to Monocle 24. With only a couple of shopping weekends before Christmas, our design editor, Hugo MacDonald, wonders why the mere mention of a sale turns shoppers into shovers.
What is it about shopping at this time of year that turns people into animals? It starts with a bang on Black Friday in the United States, the sales day after Thanksgiving, which signals the beginning of the Christmas shopping season. Footage from camera phones flooded the internet, showing Black Friday scenes that resembled the Black Hole of Calcutta. Men and women were packed so tightly that they couldn't breathe, yet they were still able to shop, or rather shove, and shout. It reached a climax at Walmart. Mosh pits erupted in an Oakland branch over 4 gigabyte memory cards costing 99 cents. In Atlanta, one woman fell headfirst into the bargain bucket amidst the crush to get towels for $1.28. She was pulled out by her legs, not in an act of charity, but because she was in the way of many more precious towels. It's amazing that there weren't any deaths this year. One Walmart employee was trampled to death in a stampede in 2008. What you can't find on YouTube is the carnage that gets left behind. I wonder what a post-Black Friday Walmart looks like. I imagine it resembles a field of corn after a biblical swarm of locusts has swept through. As retailers face the prospect of grim takings before austerity Christmas, sales are starting earlier than ever. What shops might not make in profit, they can at least get in footfall, luring present shoppers in with promises of towels for $1.28. And it's not just the Americans. We British are just as brutish when it comes to grabbing a bargain before anybody else. London's Oxford Street after work is like Walmart with no roof. The Westfield shopping centres that bookend London are like Walmarts with escalators. The goodwill that's supposed to spread at this time of year is nowhere to be found in the vicinity of a shop in sales mode. Elbows, handbags, heels and occasionally fists are the tools of the trade. This year's animal behaviour seems more riotous than ever. The message of rampant consumerism is in sharp contrast to the Occupy protests unfolding around the world. The footage has more in common with the late summer riots and looting in the UK. The lure of getting something for almost free brings out the similar levels of reckless abandon. Perhaps banning sales is the solution. It might sound brutal, particularly given the current financial climate, but maybe learning to live without fistfuls of discounted memory sticks and bargain hand towels might teach us that these things don't really make life any better. As we head into the busiest shopping weekend of the year tomorrow, watch those elbows, folks, and think twice before hitting your neighbour who gets to the till first.
That was Monocle's designer, Sir Hugo MacDonald, and that's all for this Friday edition of Midori House here in London. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, the researcher was Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. At 2200 hours London time, Emma Nelson and Indira Naidu will be back with Monocle Daily. Till then, in honour of Norman Foster's bold new plan, we'll be playing you out with Something in the Air by Thunderclap Newman. For now, from all of us here at Monocle 24, goodbye.